Accession number 34702.
Reel 3.
Eric, Denham Reel 3. So at that stage, are they trying to get you as well with the forced landing training? Are they trying to get you to have some sort of awareness of your surroundings when you're flying?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's particularly so with single-engine aircraft, of course, when you've got nothing else to fall back on except get yourself down on the ground if you can, safely.
And so, is it similar then to the sort of mechanics that you, at that stage, you're kind of getting used to the actual control of the aircraft, and it's taking you onto that secondary sort of awareness? I'm thinking of the same way as with a car, potentially. Yeah. How you, it's actually more about what's going on around
that's
you
right.
than watching what you're doing with your feet and hands.
That's right, yes.
What would you have to be aware of then on the ground? You know, if you, when you were simulating a forced landing, you said you pick a field, but are there specific things that you'd be trying to be avoid?
Yes, well, you'd obviously try to avoid wooded areas or built-up areas. Hopefully, you'd find a field which is flat, a grass field, preferably, but. Not necessarily. You have to make do with the best you could find, and you got fixed undercarriage on this aeroplane, so you couldn't bring the undercarriage up to make it easier. The danger with anything with a forced landing like that is if you hit something in the wheels and then you tip. You've seen it on the television many times, I'm sure. It tip up on its nose or tip over that way. It was only. Preferable to bailing out, of course. If you thought you could get it down on the ground and save the aircraft and save yourself, it's better than having to bail out.
Did they instruct you on should you have sort of like an engine failure on takeoff, what you were supposed to do then with a forced landing?
Yes, generally speaking, you just land straight ahead, yes. Unless you've got up sufficient speed to. Which is unlikely to, because you've got no power, you wouldn't be able to get round anywhere. Straight ahead it's different later on when you've got multi-engined aircraft and that sort of thing.
Did they try and tell you to avoid making a turn back onto the airfield? Would that be something that
you'd be? Yes, that was frowned upon. Yes. Also, in interspersed between these flights, we had the linked trainer sessions. Where you did instrument flying, so that if you're in clouds and things, you can't see the ground, can't see the horizon, you fly purely on the instruments, those basic instruments. So this was practiced in the link trainer, the forerunner of the simulators they have nowadays, of course, which are all singing and all dancing.
Can you describe to me the link trainers, and how you use them?
Well, it was like a little aeroplane, I suppose, with stubby wings, and you climbed in, and the hood came down. You couldn't see outside; all you could see was the instruments, and you did these various manoeuvres of turning and descending and all the rest of it. And I don't know whether we actually did stalling, spinning under the hood, but I can't remember now. Anyway, the idea was so you could still fly the aeroplane, because your sensory perception all goes if you lose the horizon and lose the outside view. If you're in cloud, you can imagine you're in all sorts of peculiar positions, upside down, when in fact you must believe the instruments, must believe what the instruments tell you. Otherwise, you get in trouble. So that was the reason for doing the instrument training. And then we used to do same sort of training. By then you had a hood which was put over so you couldn't see outside in the aircraft, and you could just see the instruments. You could fly simulated instrument flying in the aircraft as well.
How easy is it to trust your instruments at first?
It isn't very easy, no. You've got this feeling that you're turning, but if you it soon comes to you that if you trust the instruments, and fly by the instruments, everything would be all right.
And it's important to do that, is it?
It's very important to do that, yes.
When you were using the Link Trainer for that, is it recorded in any way as to what you're doing?
I don't know. I don't think so. No, I think the instructor, there's an instructor there, and he could see what you were doing, and that was it. It was very basic.
Was it useful, though?
Yes. Oh, yes. It was useful. Because it saved aircraft flying time, and you could get the instrument training done on the ground in the same way that flight simulators now are used for most of the training of airline pilots, rather than taking up a very expensive aeroplane and flying it around.
Can you give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of the Stearman as an aircraft?
Well, it was a twin engine.
Single engine.
Sorry, a single-engine twin biplane with a Lycoming engine, and used as a trainer, purely and simply, I think, and that was it.
How did it handle?
It handled quite easily, quite nicely, similar to the Tiger Moth, but I'd say it was a bit bigger, a bit heavier, a bit more power.
Did it have any sort of vices that they
took? No real vices, no. As trainers shouldn't have, of course.
How did you progress then? Obviously, you talked about forced landings practice and straight and level flight. What were the kind of next stages that you did?
Well, same things like the spinning and the forced landings, taking off out of wind, in other words, with a crosswind and that sort of thing.
How do you achieve that?
Well, you had to keep the rudder on to keep it straight on the ground, and then once you got into the air, the whole aircraft moved, so it didn't really matter then. Because it didn't always, runways are not always into wind, of course. Then came the first solo. After about, I don't know, 8 hours, something like that, I think. Taking off into wind, as it's recorded here, and approach and landing into wind and circuit.
How did they achieve the solo with you, though? Are you suddenly just given an aircraft, or
no? You would be with an instructor. You do a couple of circuits and landings and take off, and then. It's so I'd say, right, taxi back now and I'll get out, and off you go. You're going on your own.
What are your initial sensations when you suddenly sat in that aircraft on your own?
Well, it's a bit of a thrill and a bit of trepidation, I suppose, as well. But you're just thinking to yourself, well, just do what I've been doing with the instructor and everything will be all right. And usually it is, of course. He stands on the ground watching you, hopefully. You're not going to do anything silly. And you go off and do an approach and landing, and just one first time, and go back in, taxi back in and discuss it.
And I take it your first circuit and landing was fine, was it, when you
started loading? Yeah, yeah. There was no comments here, so...
So once yes. You've soloed, how does your training start to change at all?
Well, yes, you start doing trips on your own then, of course, and practicing all these things again, you know, the turns and steep turns and circuits and stalling and spinning and forced landings and all that sort of thing, all in preparation for a check by the flight commander.
And you do those by yourself, essentially, don't you? Because until that point, you'd always done them with an instructor,
yes.
Until you solo. So yes. Is that the fact that you were almost then sent off to do them on your own?
That's right, yes. You'd still, in between, do some dual trips as well, just to so you could check you hadn't got into any bad habits or doing anything wrong.
Is it a case that sometimes people get slightly over-ambitious once they've soloed the aircraft?
Well, it's possible, I suppose, but I don't... Generally, I think it's more the other way, that they're being ultra-cautious, making sure that they do everything right. It's much later on in their flying careers that they start to be more adventurous, I think.
So was there a case at this, though? Because, I mean, obviously, I know everybody had done grading school in the UK.
Mm.
But was there a case of anybody who wasn't taking to this the flying at all at this stage?
Oh, yes, we continued to lose people on the way, yes, for various reasons. We never really knew why, but they either weren't coping with it or decided themselves they weren't up to it.
And is this just something that they're just not getting it?
That's right.
Is that essentially what it would be?
The instructors would... They know from experience how people should progress. And if somebody wasn't progressing all that well, then they'd probably recommend a check ride with the flight commander or squadron commander or something like that. And then they would assess whether it was worth continuing with it or whether it should be taken off.
And I'm assuming as well that because you're all volunteered for air crew, that I imagine most of your fellow trainee pilots at that stage were keen to progress, were they?
Yes, very keen. Yes, they were.
Were your days divided as well? Did you have ground school and flying?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, and then subsequently we went on to night flying, of course, was the next stage.
In the Stearman?
Yes.
So, again, what does that entail, then?
Well, virtually much the same, except you did it at night time. You started off with a bit of dual. A flare path would be laid out on the airfield, and you go through the same sort of procedures. You wouldn't do stalling and spinning at night and things like that, but, you know, take-off, landings, turns, descending and climbing, all the rest of it. And then eventually you'd be sent off again solo, night solo, to do your night solo.
And with that, what was the visibility like?
Well, the visibility was usually pretty good down there. The main problem was mosquitoes at night time in Florida. It was dreadful. The airfield was situated on the southern shore of Lake Okeechobee. That's a very big lake in the centre of Florida. And at night time, you had to cover yourself up completely. Otherwise, you'd be bitten badly by mosquitoes.
Can I ask, actually, when you were down there? Because obviously it's in tropical conditions. What would you wear when you were flying?
We just wore our uniforms. And flying suits, sorry. We were RAF flying suits we wore.
So you'd done your instrument training and you'd done your night flying.
Mm.
Was there any other elements at this stage that you were involved in?
No, I think we just carried on doing all this stuff, and aerobatics then came into it.
Oh,
I started doing aerobatics.
So what type of aerobatics could you achieve in the Stearman?
Well, you could do slow rolls, barrel rolls, loops, that sort of thing.
Can you take me through those, Eric? What all those different manoeuvres are and how you achieve it in an aircraft?
It's a bit difficult to explain. The loop is the easiest, obviously, to explain. You make sure you've got sufficient height, is obviously the main thing. Put the aircraft into a dive to build up speed, and then just... I forget what the speeds would be, but... Then start easing the control column back so that you come up and over the top and down back again. Another way of doing that would be to do a roll off the top, where you do the loop, but when you're upside down, you roll the aircraft so that you're the right way up. And a slow roll, well, That's quite complicated, actually, but obviously it means rotating the aircraft in level flight, so that you start with the wings level, you go right over and upside down, and then come back in, the wings are level again.
Are you aiming in that to be in the same
yes.
sort of level right. of sky,
yes.
essentially?
Yes.
What about...
Because you could do side slip and all the rest of it, make a mess of it, and... But
what are you doing with the controls while you're achieving that slow roll? What do you have to be doing?
Well, you have to move the control column over and use the rudder to keep straight, and... till you go upside down, and then... continue around the other way and come back the right way up again.
And you mentioned the barrel roll as well. How's
well,
a
that was a slow roll would be maintaining the same axis. A barrel roll would be more of a using the airspace to difficult to explain really, but not maintaining the same axis, but rolling in a barrel, if you like, if you think
so
of a barrel.
So you would swing out more,
yeah.
would you, and
yes.
do it that way?
Yeah.
Were you with an instructor for aerobatics?
Initially, yes. Oh, yes. Initially, you were shown how to do it, and then do it yourself, and you make any corrections, and then later on, when you were doing your solos, you could practice them yourself.
Did you enjoy aerobatics? Because I know with some people, that when they were training, they don't necessarily enjoy it as such. What about yourself?
Yes, I quite enjoyed them, yes. I wasn't madly keen, but you got used to it, and yes, I enjoyed doing them. Yes, you felt an achievement, I suppose, in getting round and trying to do it accurately.
So anything else then, Eric, that you did was along with the aerobatics?
No, I think that was it then, the steep turns and... Oh, what else have we got here? Low flying, we did some low flying. You know, we're down to about 200 feet above the ground, that sort of thing.
Did you have an area allocated to do,
yes,
do low flying?
Yes, I think so, yes, if I remember rightly. And then we went on to navigation stuff like cross-country flights, map reading, pinpointing and all that sort of thing. And
so can I ask then, with the navigation for the cross-countries, how do you achieve that? Because you mentioned obviously basic navigation earlier, where you would obviously put it out on a map, but when you're in the air, how does that differ from the sort of paper record?
Well, if you haven't got a navigator, you're just flying by yourself, you'd normally do it with a map. If you wanted to go from A to B, you would put your track on there. You could see then, hopefully, that things on the ground you could check, like rivers and railway lines, all the rest of it. If you were given the wind, then you could allow for the wind by offsetting your heading to allow for the wind. And basically you would do it by map reading if you're on your own.
So essentially at that point when you were training, it was an awful lot to do with what's on the ground.
Yes.
Would you with that then, obviously if you were flying, would you then be adjusting your direction with what you were seeing on
the
ground?
Oh yes, you would see that. If you looked at your map, you should have flown over this particular point, and in fact it's over to one side, then you could adjust then and put your heading to get you back on track, because the wind was stronger than anticipated or something like that.
And with a cross country, would it be flying to another airfield?
Not in this case, that came much later on where we did actual cross-country. We just go around a certain route and be told to go to A, to B, to C, to D, and back again.
And would you be timing yourself on these sections?
Oh, yes, you have a time for each leg, yes.
I mean, is that, I take it that's if you've gone wrong, you've got a rough idea that you've gone over at the wrong period of time.
Yes, yes. You would be looking for some identifiable feature on the ground to reposition yourself if you've gone wrong.
And how easy was it to navigate in Florida?
It wasn't too bad, no. I mean, the weather was generally good there. That was one of the reasons, of course, they put these training facilities in places like Canada and America and South Africa, because the weather was that much better than this country, and things could be achieved more quickly.
And I take it at stages throughout this period of your training, you're assessed, are you, by...
Well, your own instructor is assessing you, and then you come on to the when you're nearing the end of that bit of training, that be a check ride by flight commander or something like that. I imagine somewhere in here. Well, I can't see it. No, it wouldn't appear there any particular check ride, just your instructor deciding that you could go on to the next stage, onto the next aircraft.
So you're not sat there saying you have to go through a series or set of manoeuvres?
No, not at that stage. It is later on with the Harvard. But here I don't see any check ride there at all, just...
And can I actually ask about this, though? Because you've been issued with a logbook at that point.
Mm.
Do you fill in the logbook after each day?
Yes.
As to what you did and how you did it?
That's right. And then it's... you totaled it up every month. Like that.
So you would total up the number of hours?
Yes. Yeah. Then be signed by the flight commander that it was correct. And the hours were correct. And the wing commander signed over there. So that was it. Then you, at the end of that particular course, you would total all that up again before you went on to the next stage of training.
And am I right in thinking that the training in America, that you had numbers of exercises within the sequence of instruction? Would that be right? The each exercise was numbered as to what you were doing?
Yes. That's correct, yes. They all had numbers there, yes. Like 28 was forced landings, 25 was aerobatics, 35 was aerobatics, etc., yes.
So everything would have a different number for a different exercise or...
Yes, that's correct, yes.
So what happened when you finished...
The primary course. Went on to the advanced course then, on the 86A, which in the RAF was called the Harvard.
Was it at the same location?
Same location, yes.
So did you just move across the airfield to...
Didn't move anywhere, really. Just went on to the next... There were three courses there at any one time. In progress. That was basically because before I went, they had three stages of training. They had primary, basic, and advanced. And the basic was done on a Volte and then advanced on the Harvard. But they did away with the intermediate one and just had primary and advanced. But they still had the three courses running at the same time. And you sort of progressed from the junior course up, and you had more privileges as you went on, i.e. in the junior course you only had every third weekend off until you got to the advanced course, and then you had every weekend off, things like that, and you wore different flashes in your cap and didn't know which course you're on. Because the discipline side of the cadet system was run by the cadets, We had a cadet squadron leader, a cadet flight commander, and so on. There was no other than the adjutant and the wing commander, there was nobody else running the discipline side of it or the admin side.
Was that because it was a civilian run operation, yes, essentially?
Yes.
Can I ask about the instructors you had there? Mm. And I was thinking in the primary stage. Who were the... Did you have one specific instructor, or did you have...
They tried to try to keep the same instructor most of the time. I had a chap called Lefwich most of the time, styled as a second officer. But occasionally I would fly with others. And... Oh, there's a check ride I did, yes. Flight Commander King, check ride. And a second officer, Archibald. So otherwise, it was mainly those two, yes. But then going on to advanced, it was a different instructor, of course.
And were they experienced as pilots? Had they flown an awful lot of hours, these chaps who were training you?
Well, I don't know how they were chosen, really. Probably more information on the 5BFTS site of the American Air Museum thing that they did, which details how the BFTSs came into operation and how they functioned, etc.
How did you get on with your instructor?
Okay, yes, fine. I got on quite well with him, yes. He didn't have any falling out or anything like that. So on the advanced stage, of course, I'd say we had a different instructor, and he went back to, well, not back to basics, but firstly to learn about the aircraft, the feel of the aircraft, the controls and all the rest of it. Obviously, we went to a much more powerful aeroplane, faster, heavier, and required a bit more effort, a bit more...